the usual thing goes, everybody sits at the back instead of coming to the front, but I think I can still manage to see you. Let me apologize first for having a bad head cold, so especially to those who are recording this, if I burst out coughing in the middle, it might be a bit of a problem. I'm Keith Krause, I'm a professor here at the Graduate Institute, and I'm also the program director of something called the Small Arms Survey, which is a project of the Graduate Institute that's been going now for 13 years. And what I'm going to talk about today draws on some of the work that we've done and a lot of work that's been done by others on this whole issue of guns and violence and how they're related. I don't have a simple single message here, and perhaps the main reason for me to be nervous before you today is that this is a complex issue. We have huge gaps in what we know, and probably there's more that we don't know. It's a complicated issue to untangle, especially in terms of the relationship between firearms and violence, knowing that firearms are one factor that explains the incidence of violence in any given context, sometimes not even the most important one. But we'll try to untangle that a little bit and to draw out a few observations about what we know and what we don't. I'm going to first say a few words about levels of violence overall, worldwide. What are we talking about here? We talk about lethal violence. Then a little bit about the distribution of firearms, or, you know, who has guns and where. And then a tiny bit about some legislative and regulatory responses to start thinking about how these things benefit itself. And obviously this is a topic that triggers great public debate. I've been doing this work for more than 10 years, and they asked me, coincidentally, after December, to do something at the Institute, and partly because of the recent events in Dunning and Mezenau, Switzerland, mass killings, and of course the Newtown school killings last year, in which more than 20 children and 6 adults were killed. And this was, I think, a catalytic event because it's launched the first serious reflection in the United States on issues of regulation of firearms, certainly the first serious attempt in the last 2 decades, and that has triggered a lot of reflection and some interesting international comparisons, including with Switzerland. So I'm going to try and be brief also to allow for lots of questions in this. Let me start with a few headline figures. And I apologize for the facts and figures, but I think they're important to provide some context here. Roughly 520,000 people die each year violently around the world. This is in conflict and non-conflict settings, homicide, from gang violence, from interpersonal and intimate partner violence, just lethal violence. This does not include suicide, and I'm going to say a little bit about that later. Okay? It's not true that these deaths are distributed evenly around the world. But if we start with just a kind of global snapshot, I'm going to give you the violent death rate overall around the world. It would be about 7.9 per 100,000. This is the normalized sort of figure if we want to make international comparisons. So let's keep that in mind. Now, there are 58 countries that have violent death rates that are greater than 10 per 100,000. So they're well above the global average. And there's 14 that are above 30 per 100,000. These are the most intensely violent areas. Most of these are in war zones or Latin America and the Caribbean. So if I'm going to speak about guns and violence in the developed world, we're speaking about countries that are well below the global average of lethal violence already. Broadly speaking, advanced industrial states have very low, historically very low levels of lethal violence, somewhere between 1 and 3 deaths per 100,000. These figures are averages from the late 2004-2009 period. We have more recent figures, which I can give later. But countries such as Russia come in around 40th place in the world rankings. They're actually quite high, 15 deaths per 100,000. Mexico has just under 12. Brazil is about 25. South Africa is about 38. But industrial states, especially in Western Europe and elsewhere, are very low. In Switzerland, the rate of violent death is less than 1 per 100,000. France, Italy, Britain, it's a little bit above 1, 1.2, 1.4. Japan is very low, 0.4. Where's the United States in all this? Well, it's around 5.5 per 100,000. So if you take the 50 states in the developed world, the median is about 1.5. And the United States is roughly triple that, well, more than triple the median rate. So already we have an outlier here. We have the experience of advanced industrial states that range from less than 1 to around three or four, and then we have the United States. There are a few states that come in with higher rates of lethal violence than the U.S. that we would consider developed. Russia, Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarus, Moldova, Estonia, all of which are states in transition. And there's some evidence that rapid change in these countries did lead to an upward spike in especially homicide, and that has been slowly and steadily declining. So if you're judged by the company you keep, well, I think we know how to think about the relative ranking of different countries and in particular where the U.S. fits in this. Now, this is violent deaths as a whole. I haven't said anything about firearms specifically in this. Worldwide, guns account for probably between 40 and 60% of violent deaths. We don't have really good figures because a lot of countries actually don't record the cause of the death. But these numbers vary tremendously from region to region. If you go to extremely violent places such as Guatemala, the firearms are used in more than 80% of the violent deaths. Colombia, it's 80%. South Africa, it's around 45%. We can talk about that case too a little bit later. And these are all relatively high violence areas. In the United States, roughly two-thirds of the lethal violence is perpetrated with firearms. And in Switzerland and Italy, it's about the same. Germany, Netherlands, Finland, around 20 to 30%. In the UK, which has very few firearms, 6% of the deaths involve the use of guns. And Japan, which, of course, as we know, has extraordinarily strict laws and very few guns, it's less than 1% of the lethal violence is perpetrated with firearms. Now, we don't have complete figures, but I could say the norm would be somewhere between 10 and 30%, and other countries are outliers on either side of that, including the US, Italy, perhaps Switzerland on one side, Japan, and a few others on the other side. Now, there may be little variation among developed states in their rates of lethal violence, 1 to 2 per 100,000, but there's wider variation in terms of the use of firearms. So our first puzzle already emerges. Is there a clear pattern here? And the answer is there's not a straightforward pattern that explains that those countries that have slightly higher rates also have higher rates of gun violence. And so that's not the case. Okay, so the third piece of the puzzle, the first is what the lethal violence look like, the second is what role firearms play, third is where are the guns, and how are firearms and guns distributed around the world. And here, Small Arms Survey does have a kind of leading role in pulling some of this together. We estimate that there are 875 million firearms around the world, military and civilian, everything, armed forces, police, armed groups and gangs, and civilian possession. Roughly two-thirds of these are in civilian hands. So that's about 650 million. Where are they? Well, about 270 million of these civilian firearms are in the United States. So let's do a little thought experiment here. If the rest of the world was armed at the same rate that the United States is armed, there would be about 6 billion small arms and light weapons around the world, not 875 million. Now, I say this not to kind of hammer on about gun culture and firearms possession in the US, but really to say the United States is a completely unique case here in almost all ways. And it's very hard to make comparisons between it and any other country, precisely because the distribution of firearms is so widespread and common. And in other places, it's relatively rare. If we do the same kind of numbers per 100 that I gave earlier, the US comes in somewhere around 88 or 90 firearms per 100 people. The next closest country in the world is Yemen. It's around 55 per 100. Yemen does have a bit of a reputation as having a lot of guns, but it's considerably fewer than in the United States. Then we get to Switzerland and Finland, which for various reasons have around 45 guns per 100 people, and a cluster of northern European states and Canada, also northern, Sweden, Canada, France, Germany, all around 30 guns per 100 population. So well below half the rate that you have in the United States. Even further down, you get Spain, 10 guns per 100, Portugal, roughly 9, countries like Mexico, 15, and so on. There's, again, huge variation between countries that have relatively low levels of ownership among the civilian population and countries that have high, let's say the Swiss or Finnish case. And this depends, of course, on very particular factors, such as history, culture, law, traditional hunting and sporting activities, militia tradition, in the case in Switzerland, urbanization, and so on. Now, I haven't said anything yet about the states in the global south. Turns out, in fact, that in Africa and Asia in particular, these countries have relatively low levels of firearm ownership, roughly a few, always below 10 per 100 population. And this might come as a bit of a surprise to many because they think, well, these are areas in which there's high levels of violence and endemic conflicts, including in places such as Central America and elsewhere. But if you think about this in economic terms, it makes sense. A gun is a capital asset. It costs money, often quite large sums, and it's unproductive, unless, of course, you're a criminal or engaged in predatory activities. So for the poor, or even the relatively poor, owning a firearm is a luxury that they would not afford. You only need one if your personal security is not assured by your community, or if you have large capital assets. If you have a choice between a gun and a cow, you will probably want a cow. If you have 10 cows, then you might think about acquiring a firearm, often in cases where it's for self-protection. So there's not really a surprise that firearms ownership is actually concentrated and correlated with rising levels of wealth and development. Now, what that means is that on a global level, you're not going to find a simple relationship, because most of the highest violence areas, particularly Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, have relatively low levels of circulation of firearms among the civilian population. But the violence is concentrated among particular groups, among young men, in armed groups and criminal gangs. It's associated with drug trafficking, with other illicit activities, human smuggling, and so on. Now, the last piece of the puzzle here is to ask, how do states regulate firearms ownership among the civilian population? Well, they've come up with a rather bewildering array of approaches to this question. And we are often asked, who has the strongest legislation around the world? And I wish I could answer that, because it'd make a great soundbite. You could do a ranking. But in fact, there's no real easy way to answer this. We did a comparison, and I think there's a few copies of this document out there, a comparison of legislation in 2011, a little bit of publicity, to try and assess different patterns of regulation in 42 different jurisdictions. And we looked at 28 countries. We looked at every Australian territory, because it turns out that different states and territories have different laws. And of course, in the United States, every state has slightly different laws. And we only looked at six jurisdictions. We couldn't look at every state in the US. There's no international standards or agreements that govern this, and there's no real international sense of best practices either. But so what we wanted to do was just compare the different approaches to gun control and look at the similarities and differences. Well, the first distinction you can make is between those places that regard civilian firearm ownership as basic right, and there's two of them, and those that treat it as a privilege or a conditional right, and there's everybody else. Now, we know that the United States is one of those. The other one turns out to be Yemen. And you have, in some cases, you have anomalies. In Mexico, in the Constitution, it also says something about the right to keep and bear arms, but not surprisingly, this is embedded in a legal culture in which that right is immediately qualified by high and heavy strong regulations. So this distinction shapes everything else that follows in terms of the nature of controls that can and will be put in place. Now, almost all states prohibit or at least restrict civilian access to weapons that are somehow considered ill-suited for civilian use. In almost all cases, this includes automatic weapons, which really are designed explicitly for military purpose. But then the line becomes very blurry. And of course, the focus of debate in many places, in particular the United States, has been around semi-automatic weapons, which are rapid fire but not immediate fire. You still have to pull the trigger each time. And many of these semi-automatic weapons are indistinguishable from their military equivalents, except for one minor change that means that you cannot shoot as quickly as otherwise. But there's no formal distinction between civilian and military firearms. And of course, one of the reasons for that is that modern militaries have all sorts of weapons. Military officers and soldiers carry sidearms as well. So a pistol can be a military weapon if it's in the hands of the armed forces. So you can't just say by the weapon itself that you can make a distinction between its end use or its end user. Most states, the vast majority, have in place some system of licensing that is designed to prevent certain types of individuals, certain categories of individuals, from owning firearms. And this depends on such things as age, restrictions about what age you can acquire a firearm at, mental health considerations, do you have any record of having been brought into the mental health system, have you a criminal record, of course, are you drug dependent, is there an issue of public safety, have you threatened other people before, including a particular intimate partner, violence, and sometimes a competency test. Are you required to take a test of some sort of safety, safe handling for firearms? So these kinds of issues can be sort of ranged on a gradation. Some states have stricter than other requirements. One subject of heated debate is the question of self-defense. And so we tried to look at whether states allow civilians to own firearms for self-defense and personal protection. And in some countries, this is permitted. Some countries, it's actively encouraged, actually, or certainly the argument for owning firearms. In others, it's explicitly a reason to refuse license. In New Zealand, they say in their legislation, self-defense is not a valid reason for possessing a firearm. And there are very strict restrictions on circumstances under which you could use one for self-defense. And there are other requirements, like there's obligation to report theft or loss. Do you store ammunition under safe conditions? Do guns have to be locked up or not? And all of these have evolved in a context in which public safety considerations have been brought to bear on this question to try and reduce the risk of misuse, either by the owner or by somebody else, misuse and theft of these arms. Okay, so this is a quick snapshot of lethal violence, quick snapshot of where guns fit in, quick snapshot of how guns are distributed, and a few things about legislation. Now, what would this look like if I tried to pull this together and say a few words about the gun violence link? And here, again, I kind of give you a simple picture, but I'm going to make a few general points, which are sort of widely supported, although there's a lot more work to do. The first thing to note is that violence is concentrated in particular areas geographically, particular demographic groups, and it follows pathways, if you will. And certain vectors. So let's take the American example that I offered. The overall homicide rate is somewhere around 5 per 100,000, and this is below the global average, but not much, and it's above, well above the average for comparable industrial and developed states. What does this look like if we ask ourselves, what are the 10 most violent cities in the United States? Well, then the picture changes quite radically. Flint, Michigan, the rate is 64.9. which is 10 times the average, and by the way, higher than the national rate in places like Guatemala and El Salvador and South Africa. So Michigan is very dangerous. It might even be more dangerous than most war zones. I have not got the figures for Basra or Mosul, but they're unlikely to be much higher than that. Detroit is at 54. Memphis, which is bottom of the list, the top 10, has a violent homicide rate of 24, which is more than 5 times the American average. So the violence is concentrated in certain areas, certain cities, often not the largest, by the way. It's usually in the mid-sized cities, between 100,000 and a million people. And that has to do with the provision of public services, the erosion of the economic base. People know where Flint, Michigan is. There used to be auto industry there. Detroit is number 2, that's also the case. New Orleans has its own dynamic. Another way to look at this would be to cut it apart demographically, and the homicide rate in African Americans is 4 times the national average. So this is an issue that is colored by race as well. It's not distributed randomly. Now, the U.S. is not unique in having this kind of geographic and demographic concentration. This is probably true of almost all other jurisdictions. We looked a few years ago at Brazil, which is relatively high rate overall, 25 deaths per 100,000. But if you look at places such as Recife, which is a port town, lots of smuggling of drugs and lots of illicit activities, the rate there is more than 50 per 100,000. Among men in Recife, it's 125 per 100,000. And among young men between ages of 20 and 29, it's more than 300 per 100,000, which is, by any sort of public health account, epidemic levels of violence. So a national figure doesn't tell you really anything, especially for larger countries or countries that have relatively high levels. You could look at the Brazilian rate and think it's going down, but in particular areas, zones, and among particular groups, it may be going up. Now, in countries that have very low levels of violence, you can't actually cut it apart that way. Switzerland's rate, which varies between sort of 7.7 or 1 per 100,000 a year, this means really 50 deaths a year. And anybody who's done statistics knows that you cannot start cutting that apart into urban, rural, different demographics, and so on. In the UK, which is also an interesting case, there are about 700 to 800 cases of lethal violence each year, but only about 50 of these are done with firearms. I actually think there's one criminologist for every firearm murder in the United States, probably one criminologist studying them, because they looked at this closely, but the phenomenon is quite rare, and you cannot make any kind of generalizations about this. So what's important here is to look at the pathways that the violence follows as well. And this has been done with some innovative techniques of social network analysis among particular subgroups. And one study that was done recently in Boston looked at a particular group, not because they were specifically prone to violence, but because they were easy to isolate geographically, in other words. And it was immigrants from Cape Verde, who live in a particular neighborhood and some of them were involved in drug trafficking. So they did a social network map, which some of you might be interested in trying to do in your own work, and literally plotting the distance between individuals on this map. Who knew who? How did they fit together? And then highlighting who had been victims of violence, who had been shot or killed in that network, and what was your risk as you moved further away from that person. And the answer was, each step in the node away from a particular victim, your risk of being shot dropped by 25%. And this tells you that it's really completely linked to other patterns of social interaction. It is not a random phenomenon, and violence is almost never, in fact, random. It doesn't spread epidemically, invisibly through society, the way you could think of it as epidemiology or disease models, but actually follows along particular networks that are involved in often illicit activities. So that's the first big takeaway that you need to think about. If you're going to try and tackle the question of lethal violence, and guns are one part of that puzzle, you have to think about who's affected, where, under what circumstances, and for what reasons, rather than just a blanket approach to the problem. I said at the outset that I didn't include the figures for suicide, and almost none of the sort of lethal violence that people look at internationally includes that. But as the World Health Organization points out, it's a huge part of the global burden of violence. Roughly 1 million suicides a year, which is more than twice the total of interpersonal violence. And from a public health perspective, this is, of course, it is self-inflicted, but it is still violence, and these deaths are tragic and often preventable. Now, why would we think that that might be something interesting to look at, to the link between guns and suicides? Well, there's a couple of things that we know. First off, suicide attempts are often transient. People who survive a suicide attempt rarely try again. And that means that prevention will have some significant benefits. Second piece of the puzzle is that when you use a firearm, you're very likely to succeed. So in Canada, 92% of suicide attempts with a firearm resulted in death. And only 23% of attempted drug overdoses resulted in death. So it makes a huge difference whether or not firearms are available and how they can be used. And the consensus is that regulatory measures that reduce the availability of firearms in private households can strengthen the prevention of firearm suicides. This is pretty much shown in all places, at all times. And this is, I think, a big public health problem. The third thing to look at in a snapshot is the relationship between guns and intimate partner violence. Usually, but not always, violence against women, but the vast majority of intimate partner violence is men against women. Here too, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that a gun in the home is a risk factor for intimidation and for killing of women in their homes. And it's more likely to be used to threaten intimates, that is family members, than it is to protect against intruders. Okay? This is a message that is often delivered in the United States. When people say, well, I need to acquire a gun or protect myself against intrusion. Well, maybe the one person who has that gun is protecting themselves, but everybody else in that household is less secure as a result. Women, children, but also children at risk of accidents. Only have to Google this to find cases of children playing with guns and shooting themselves, etc. And a study, a 2003 kind of meta-analysis, found that women living with a gun in a home, or in a home that had a gun in it, were more than three times likely to be murdered than women who were living in households that had no guns. So this is clearly a link that needs to be explored. Now, there are some other kinds of paradoxes here. This is a simple picture. It actually implies that we should look closely at this. But when we take a global perspective, and this is a puzzle to which I have no clear explanation, but it's worth looking at, those countries that have very high levels of violence, the percentage of the victims that are women is relatively low. Those countries that have relatively low overall levels of violence, the percentage of victims that are women starts to approach 50-50. So this is particularly important for advanced industrial states. You go to Norway, very low level of violence overall, but almost half the victims are women. You go to Guatemala, 10-15% of the victims are women. So there seems to be some kind of relationship here. As a society deals with the kinds of violence that affects it, you start with large scale, let's call it conflict-related violence or gang violence or interpersonal violence that occurs in public spaces, in the streets, and these get addressed through change in social values, availability of weapons, general increases in wealth, young men being employed and not active. And at the end, when you've peeled away all of these things, what you're left with is intimate partner violence as a more and more significant part of the total. So that's one kind of hypothesis here. But we don't really know why this relationship holds true. And it is a paradox, certainly for advanced industrial and developed states. Okay, the last thing I want to say, so we have lots of time for questions, is to address one of the most common arguments that's made here, which is that, well, if people don't have guns, they're going to kill each other with other means, okay? Or they may kill themselves with other means. I've already pointed out that, you know, in the case of suicide, that might not be true, or at least they might try but not succeed, and it makes a big difference. But in fact, the evidence for this displacement effect is not very strong. And if you look at the Australian example, which is probably the single best case we have of a country that had, in 1996, as a result of a particular massacre of 35 people in Port Arthur, Tasmania, they had a large-scale gun buyback that took about a million firearms out of circulation. They changed the laws in various ways. And then the question is, well, what difference did this make in the intervening 15 years? Well, it is true that the homicide rate was already diminishing somewhat, but the one thing that's absolutely clear is there was no displacement from firearms to other methods. You know, taking the firearms out of circulation meant that that homicide rate went down dramatically, and it did not result in a higher level of homicides by other means. So the overall rate of homicide in Australia dropped by about half over this sort of 15 or 20 year period. That's kind of significant, actually. It's also worth knowing that in the 10 years before the Port Arthur massacre, there had been 11 mass shootings, about 100 victims. Mass shooting is usually anything more than three people. Two doesn't count for some reason. But they had 11 mass shootings, about 100 victims in that decade before. And since 1996, the number of mass shootings is zero. Now, there might be a particular reason for this. Mass shootings require high firepower. It doesn't happen with knives and doesn't claim victims. And that this is, I think, of course, a lesson that might be particularly pertinent in some policy areas, in some areas where they get a lot of public attention. And the final thing to be said about firearms and displacement is that even if violence still occurs by other means, it's much less likely to have a lethal outcome, and it's much less costly in whatever way you want to think about cost, whether it's direct cost in hospitals, whether it's loss of productivity from people being injured in our disability, or whether it's long-term loss of quality of life and trauma. And we did look at this, and the average cost of treating gunshot wounds is more than $300,000 in the United States, and stab wounds, it was somewhere just over $200,000. So again, from a public health perspective, it makes a difference what kind of means people use. both in terms of the actual direct impacts, but also I think the trauma and the associated long-term consequences of violence. Okay, I'm going to stop so that we have some questions, because I think you probably have a few questions. These have been a series of snapshots, and that was partly by design, but it's also partly because that's the nature of our knowledge right now. We don't have a big systematic picture. We can't make large-scale generalizations with nice curves and so on, but we are slowly filling in more and more pieces of this puzzle, and I look forward to your questions, comments, critical observations, if there are any. I think I can share the questioning myself, or maybe unless somebody else. Mm-hmm. Yep. Identify yourself.
Paul Gould, freelance analyst.
Okay.
My question is, do you think efforts to for gun control, let's take the United States for, because it's one of the easier examples to use, do you think, in terms of dealing with gun control efforts, do you think that we should also tie in economic development policies? Because you're talking about Detroit and Flint, and that focus could be at times too narrow on trying to restrict access, and maybe we should start thinking about community empowerment programs or job placement programs. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you say that would be an interesting kind of use of policy to abate gun violence in these areas?
Well, I'm going to say no, but I'm going to qualify that, okay? But the reason to say no is because, first off, there's no simple relationship between poverty and violence, right? That we know for sure, or between poverty and conflict at the global level. And in any particular environment, the percentage of people who are actually violent actors or violence entrepreneurs is relatively low. So most young men in inner cities, in Flint and elsewhere, are not violent. They're not part of the gang network. And this is also true in East Africa and elsewhere. So, if your specific goal is targeting violence and violent actors, there are lots of other reasons to promote development, right? But it's not necessarily the tool that's actually going to address this particular piece of the problem most effectively and most directly. And I think there are many others, that, as it were, cofactors that are a little bit more significant.
Yes. Are there some surveys about links between...
Can you speak up, please?
Are there some surveys about the links between production of mm-hmm. small armament and violence and the mm-hmm. availability for yep. people to buy it around the world?
Yes, but not as many as you would think. And in fact, there's, of course, from a police perspective, the one thing that they wish to know is where do the guns come from? But there's no relationship between those countries that actually produce firearms and have high levels of violence domestically. But in some cases, looking at this link has led to some very interesting legislative change. So a former student of mine and an NGO in Brazil, Viva Rio, looked at the guns that had been seized by the Rio de Janeiro police over a long period. And you know, the police had a couple hundred thousand of these weapons, essentially in a basement warehouse. They didn't have time to catalog them and look at where they'd been coming from. So this NGO went in there and with a bunch of students, and it actually did this. And then it started to try and trace back where these weapons were from, and it turned out a very high percentage of them were made in Brazil. So they went to the manufacturers and said, what's going on here? And the manufacturers said, oh, well, but we exported those weapons to Paraguay. And it turned out there was, in fact, a fictional circuit where the weapons were allegedly exported, probably certainly never crossed the border, although some pieces of paper did, and then leaked into illicit and criminal markets. And manufacturers then took a step to significantly increase their controls on this. And that did lead to some measurable reductions in the case of Brazil and Rio. Now, that's one case. I don't think there's a link between the fact that Italy happens to manufacture or Austria happens to manufacture handguns and levels of violence there. And one little secret is that European-made weapons are extremely popular in the United States. And so, you know, there might be a touch of hypocrisy about the Europeans being so critical of a kind of a culture of acquisition of guns to which they also contribute by and profit from. I think that would be worth underlining. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, many, many thanks indeed. It's basically not, it was terrifying in what you were saying, but to some extent also can be comforting. Did I understand you correctly that you said that the less violence on the street, the more at home?
Not quite. But as violence in the street goes down,
yes,
violence at home does not go down at the same rate. So when you deal with these other forms, what you're left with is violence that is in the home, in a sense. And it's, you can see this as a layer cake, in a certain sense, where we develop public policies to tackle these other kinds of violence, and what's left over is that that occurs in the private sphere, so-called, intimate partner violence. So from a public policy point of view, you want to focus on the things that are not yet being resolved. But it's not that it's increasing. It's just the, it's more prominent part of what's left over. And then over here.
Could regulation of, you know, gun-linked violence go through the regulation of ammunition rather than the guns themselves?
It appears that the Second Amendment does not protect the right to, does not protect ammunition. So that's one, you know, plausible pathway in certain places. There's kind of a yes and a no, or good news and bad news answer to this. The no part is that ammunition is relatively easy to produce, including, you know, with a small hand press and a few supplies in your garage, as my father did for all of his hunting friends. So that doesn't require much to produce your own. It's probably more promising regulatory mechanism in areas that are high violence, both war and non-war zones, where in countries in Central America, so Guatemala, if you had restrictions on the amounts that you could purchase, or some kind of regulations around that, you might actually reduce the availability. We know from some conflict zones that when armed groups have limited access to ammunition, they're much less likely to prey on civilians. And that kind of makes sense. So an armed group is engaged in sort of a struggle against either another group or the government, and ammunition is short, then there are strict rules about how it's used. So there is some evidence that it might be a helpful policy tool. And in any case, it's almost certainly a good idea to have rules and regulations around storage. I think in Canada, could be wrong, but I think it's in Canada that, that ammunition must be stored, but not within reach of the guns in a certain sense. It's not in the same place. One of the big changes that occurred in Switzerland, they decided that they would keep military style weapons for the militia in the household, but they changed the rules governing the ammunition, which are no longer stored there. And this was an attempt to kind of break the possibility of, you could call it the passionate or rather spontaneous use of these kinds of weapons. So it does clearly seem to make a difference.
You talked about lethal violence, but my question is, what about like the threat that if they use guns, I think about sexual violence here. Or do we have any data on this?
No. I mean, that's not completely true. There are different ways to look at this. So one kind of rule of thumb is that for every violent death, there's probably three injuries. And of course, this varies by context, but that gives you kind of a ballpark figure. So there's a lot of victims of violence who do not die. And that could be a significant, in fact, sometimes a greater social cost in terms of the public health and long-term disabilities and caregiver burden. So we know a little bit about that just sort of in general. We know almost nothing about how it works in conflict zones. And we don't know much about the use of firearms as threats. That is to say, to perpetrate other forms of violence, but a gun may be required to do that, especially for sexual violence, and how it fits into the sort of broader package. And I think this is a problem that bedevils also the criminological literature. They don't have really good data on things like, you know, robberies that are perpetrated with firearms or carjackings with arms, etc. So they can't kind of unpack the broader uses of these. What we do know from some research on gangs and criminal groups is that, especially if it's a criminal group engaged economic activities, whether it's drug smuggling or whatever, they have a strong interest in keeping levels of violence down because that attracts attention and it's bad for business. So, but they may be using guns a lot within their community and the police and to run their protection rackets and so on, but that's not going to show up in the figures of lethal violence. So, you know, in Southeastern Europe, in the Balkans, there's not a lot of lethal violence, but there's a lot of fairly large-scale criminal activity going on in which guns are one part of that puzzle. But from a policy point of view, you probably don't need to tackle the issue of firearms regulation and control. You have bigger problems of criminality, which will involve, you know, these lesser forms of violence.
Yep. Yeah, sort of connected to that question then, would the United States be even more of an outlier if you were shot and you didn't have quick access to a doctor, as most of the states do? I mean, there are probably many more attempts than actual homicide.
One of the studies in New York, and I'm going to take a pass on the exact figures here, but they claimed that, because there's been a reduction in the homicide rate in the United States, gone down, and many opponents of gun control will say, you know, this has been going down and we haven't been increasing the regulation of guns, so the guns are clearly not important here. But this study showed that one third of the decline was accountable or could be accounted for by the fact that there had been dramatic improvements in rapid and emergency treatment of firearms wounds. So, people who would have been dead 10 years ago were not dead now, right? And so suddenly it didn't count as a homicide, and your homicide rate goes down because they're being saved. And, you know, in a sort of paradoxical way that shows that the links between sort of conflict and non-conflict violence, the reason this went down is because the United States had a lot of well-trained doctors after militaries from Vietnam experience and elsewhere that were able to, and this is where many of these techniques of rapid response were developed within the military. It's also true that it works the other way, that physicians that are being deployed in the field in Iraq were sent to inner city hospitals in California and Los Angeles to get trained at, you know, emergency treatment of gunshot wounds, which they then were deployed in the field. And you can find some rather dramatic slideshows, as doctors often like to present to each other, about how it is that they treat these wounds. So that has made a big difference. And in other countries, you know, the rate of lethal violence might be partly accounted for by the difficulty we have in getting to getting any kind of rapid health care, emergency care. Mm-hmm.
To the same direction, if I understood correctly, the figures given are of use of firearms that resulted to lead to death.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But then, to what extent your group, the fact that developed countries have better hospitals and then less the violence won't result in death. That is, to what extent that affected the results we are having right now?
Yeah.
The better health system.
Yeah, the only example I could offer was essentially the longitudinal one, where you could look at one city and improvements in survival rates of gunshot victims over time and show that this had improved. It would be useful, but at this point nobody has done it, to do this kind of comparison cross-nationally, but it wouldn't be impossible. You would simply need to capture some sense of who was brought to, you know, hospitals with gunshot injuries and what's the case survival rate, to use the medical term, for this, of these injuries. And now, the complicating factor, of course, would be what kind of guns are used. And I didn't talk about that at all, but the National Institute of Justice, I think, in the United States, has a kind of a lethality index that they use for police forces when they're doing things like buying bulletproof vests and so on, that ranks the lethality of different firearms 1 to 6 scale. And for those of you who have not actually been around or used firearms, it's a huge difference in the relative power, accuracy, penetrating force, lethality, and wound ballistics of different kinds of guns. And so this is partly why when people focus on taking out specific forms of weapons, they do that because these are the ones that are most likely to cause more severe damage, injury, or death. So it's not just a purely political thing, it's also, you know, focusing on those weapons that are the most likely to commit damage. And in other, you know, you have to try and control for that somehow, you know, where people being shot in one place with small caliber pistols and other places with assault rifles or vice versa. And I don't know, we often don't have reliable enough information to do that. Yeah?
Can you make a link between violent action movies and games and the increasing violence in the developer world?
Yeah, no. I mean, people would wish to or would like to try to, but and this speaks to one of the problems with doing research on violence, because at the end of the day, it's often understood as an individual act. And so what you do is you look for what are the characteristics of the perpetrator, you know, who is actually committing this violent act, whether it's with a firearm or not, and what are their intentions and how does it happen. And it's very hard to relate any individual behaviors to a mass phenomenon such as advertising or video game use or exposure to violent movies or anything like that. And so this is a sociological problem that doesn't just bedevil the kind of research that you could do on firearms violence. And so most of the focus has been on, well, what were the characteristics of this particular person and what member of what kind of larger group of people were they? Young men unemployed, inner cities linked to particular trade or drug trafficking, how does that work? And now all that means is that all I've said is we can't make the link more easily or easily at all. Does that mean there is no link? No, the absence of evidence of a link does not mean there is no link. It just means we don't really know how to show that. And some scholars of culture have sort of tried to do this in a more systematic way, but it's extremely difficult. Yep.
I just had a quick question. You said 88 to 90 guns per 100 people in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if that means that people have more than one gun, if a lot are going mm-hmm. to Mexico, mm-hmm. if you have any information on
that. Those are two separate questions. Okay. So let me tackle the non-Mexico one. It turns out that we made the New York Times, actually, yesterday, I think, or the March. One of the regular surveys in the United States done, and this one showed that there has been a systematic four-decade decline in the percentage of households that have guns in the United States. Okay. Now, that's at the same time as the sort of overall guns per 100 has been stable or increased. So the obvious conclusion is that it's the same people who have one or two guns who are requiring more. And there's some evidence from that, from gun shoes. This particular story was accompanied by a picture, and I kind of looked very hard to see any person of color or of a female gender in that picture. I did not find a whole lot of white middle-aged men. And this is people who've gone to gun shows and done this study. It's concentrated among a particular demographic, people who collect weapons, who often own 5, 10 or more of these. So one part of the picture is that it's also concentrated more in the south and the northeast and in the rural areas and the urban areas. And so there's lots of reasons to think that gun ownership is not distributed evenly among populations. On the Mexico thing, I'm going to go on a little tangent here, because it's certainly the case that a large number of the weapons that are seized by the Mexican police or army as a result of either clashes with or when drug gangs get in fights, they often leave the weapons behind because that way you're not traceable to it, etc., etc. They've seized something like 90,000 weapons. This is now a couple of years old, but over a few year period, they've seized about 90,000 weapons. And they submitted 30,000 of these to TRACE, to the United States. They sort of took records of serial numbers, makes and models, and then asked the U.S. officials would trace these guns to gun owners. And of the weapons that they submitted to TRACE, of those 30,000, something like 80% of them had come from the United States. And there are some interesting maps of showing exactly what gun shops they were being acquired in along the border, and there was a systematic trade of people who were being used to straw purchase, it's called, purchase weapons that were then being given to the drug groups. Now, what that turned into in the news was 80% of the guns seized in Mexican drug wars come from the U.S. Of course, that's not what I said. 80% of the 30,000 that were submitted to TRACE. The question is, where did the other 60,000 come from? And if you're a Mexican police officer and you've seized a bunch of weapons, you will submit those to Trace that you at least have a logical reason to think may have come from the United States. So you're not going to ask the U.S. if this grenade launcher was purchased in a gun shop in Texas, because they don't sell grenade launchers, at least not yet, in these gun shops. Or if it's a fully automatic weapon that looks like the kind that is used by the Mexican armed forces, you're not going to submit that to Trace either. So there, what we don't really know is a lot about the trafficking patterns, but from everywhere else, criminal groups obtain weapons where they're most easily obtainable, which in the Mexican case includes south of the border, where there are large stocks of military-style weapons still in circulation from the civil wars down there, where there are clear links between the Mexican drug gangs and various gangs operating in Central America. And they'll also seize them in an environment in which an extremely high percentage of the police and, are corrupt. You can expect that that corruption also includes selling off your weapons, which happens elsewhere. So the Mexican picture is more complicated than the simple public narrative, but a lot of guns have been flowing south, and this is a serious sore point in Mexican-American relations. I might add parenthetically, a small but significant number of guns have gone north, too, into Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, and big cities in Canada, which have had significant spikes in firearms violence, with often with guns that are clearly brought in from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. What kind of method countries use to reduce the amount of guns among civilians? Mm-hmm. For example, change to food, to money, mm-hmm. and what kind of, what else they can do?
Mm-hmm. There have been some large-scale civilian collection efforts. In the Australian case, is there an Australian expert in the room? The Australian case, it was a buyback where they essentially established a price list. You know, what is the relative value of these different weapons? and through that, you know, they invested a lot of money, but they took out approximately a million guns out of circulation. In Rio de Janeiro, again, a public-private partnership between the NGO and the local police had an amnesty. They did not buy back the guns, but over the span of a couple of years, people brought in 500,000 weapons to be destroyed. They didn't receive any compensation for that, but there was a public awareness campaign about guns circulating on the street, the risk of them being lost and stolen. And I was there where that was undertaken, and you could literally, people coming in at their lunch hours with paper bags, which made you a little nervous sometimes because you needed to make sure these things were unloaded and safe before you destroyed them. But you know, sometimes you can do this without compensation. In post-conflict zones, it's often part of connected to disarmament. Demobilization packages, training and reintegration for ex-combatants, and in places like Haiti, they've tried to apply this to gang members as well. But you have to be very careful that one result is that you don't actually compensate or raise the status of the people who have guns by giving them, you know, privileged access to certain kinds of things that other people don't have. So one thing they tried to do, they proposed in Haiti, was that there would be a friendly football match between the Haitian and the Brazilian team, and they were going to give free tickets, a ticket to every gun that was turned in. And there was a significant outcry among the community that said, you know, this is the most valuable commodity in Haiti right now, is one of these tickets. Do you really want the people to who have guns to get first access to this? So they came up with something slightly different. But you have to be quite careful when you think about these kind of incentive programs not to get that negative blowback. Other questions or comments? Then I think we hit the hour. Okay, well, as I said at the outset, small arms survey has been around for a while. There are some of the staff in the room. None of them stood up to correct me, so I think I didn't say anything completely wrong, although I'll be told about that later. But we are here, if any of you are actually interested in pursuing this, either for information purposes or for your own work, and thank you for coming.